Welcome along to another edition of the D Word podcast, where we talk dementia. My guest this week is Scott Rose, who records his experience caring for his wife Maureen in the book We Danced, Our Story of Love and Dementia. Well, Scott, it's great to welcome you as my guest here on the D Word. The book is called We Danced, Our Story of Love and Dementia, and we'll get around to talking about that, I'm sure, fairly shortly. But, you know, the focus on the book is Maureen. Tell us a little bit about Maureen before a diagnosis.
Maureen and I had been married about 16 years before the dementia hit, and had Maureen was a very gracious, very kind, very nurturing person, always willing to help others, but also very quiet, sort of gentle soul. She never wanted to be the center of attention. She was happy supporting others. And what I found intriguing about her, and she impacted my life in a way, is that she could appreciate the little things. And she was as much in awe chasing whales off the Kauai coast as she was looking at the hummingbirds in her garden, and rocking her grandchild to sleep. It was just, she appreciated everything around her, and that just made it very enjoyable to be with her.
And, you know, obviously at one point you did notice that maybe things weren't quite right with Maureen. When did that happen?
Well, that was in early 2016. And, you know, hindsight is amazing in that you can look back and say, well, maybe there was a symptom in 2015 or 2014, but those one-offs you tend not to overreact to. But in early 2016, I started to see a collection of symptoms almost daily. Definitely a change in behavior. Maureen had contracted primary progressive aphasia as a subtype of FTD, or frontal temporal dementia, and that really affected her language and her executive functions. And when I started to see multiple things occurring, for instance, I'd ask her how her day was, and she went from telling me a story or a narrative into just simple one-word answers. Oh, it was fine. It was okay, which seemed odd to me. And we would be doing the dishes together, and I'd be rinsing them off and handing them to her, and she'd be sticking them in the dishwasher. Then all of a sudden she changed and dried them and put them in the cupboard. And I said, well, honey, those aren't clean yet. And she'd go, oh, yes. She would stare long minutes at the coffee maker, kind of unsure where to go to next. And through noticing these the series of issues, I sat her down. I said, hey, it looks like something's off here, sweetheart. And, you know, at that point, dementia was the furthest thing from my mind. Neither of us had a history of dementia in our family. And I thought, well, maybe this is just some deficiency that we need to get addressed. You know, iron deficiency, who knew what? I hadn't really researched anything at that point. And I had told her that it seemed like it made her feel sad. And she said it does, because she was aware of it and grappling with it. And I convinced her to go to the doctor. And oftentimes people with FTD, it could be years in terms of diagnosis. We were able to push for multiple appointments very close together because it was weighing heavy on her mind. Something was going on. And we were able to get a diagnosis in about 3 months, which was wonderful. But also tragic when we found out what it was. But we had a neurologist that happened to have experience with FTD. Many don't. And she was able to clearly identify with MRI scans and some tests.
So, you know, at that stage, you're faced with this FTD, which there are numerous types of dementia. It's one of the rarer forms, if we can say that, of dementia. I mean, what kind of support did you get, or, you know, preparation for what the future was going to look like?
Not a lot of support. It's important that you create a support network, but this had caught us so off guard. I facilitate now, you know, in her honor, a dementia caregiver support group, and we meet monthly, and I hear where they're at in their journey, and I help offer counsel, and then we offer counsel within the group. And that's something that I preach a lot. I say, you need to get support. You need to get support of professionals, of family, of friends, but have people that you can call quickly that can either you can connect with. It was one of those things where do as I say, not as I do, because I just didn't have that support network right near us. And people do, they have their own lives and they get very busy with those and they can't sort of suspend those to help with that caregiving. And we have sort of the three D's when that diagnosis occurs is there's the denial, nothing's wrong. They're sort of disappearing. They just they leave. They think that they'll cause problem by being there, if you will. And then there's sort of the armchair diagnosis. Oh, well, probably what it is just this. You know, it's not dementia, it's something else. And none of those things really help. And so you are constantly looking at, and I think you build throughout the journey, this support network. Where can I grab from and get some help for this or that? Because early on, she could travel fine. We could go to the store. We could do things, and it was okay. But as the dementia progressed, there were times where I needed to go take care of just errands, and it was going to create agitation for her. So looking for somebody that could sit with her for a couple hours. As we look at professional social workers, we took a look at speech pathologists, financial consultant, because there was going to be a financial strain as well. Hit and miss on those. And also, too, is that your loved one with dementia has to be willing to participate in that as well. She was very frustrated with the speech pathologist. That didn't last very long. Hers was, as I mentioned, the primary progressive aphasia, the language variant. You know, the one that Bruce Willis is currently struggling with. He has the same subtype. And so a speech pathologist working with her, she was more inclined to shut down than she was to sort of work through those words. And so, yeah, support network became a bit of a struggle. It wasn't until 2 years into the disease that I discovered the Association for FTD or the AFTD.org. And they very much specialize on FTD. And they were a tremendous resource. I had certainly been researching and reading a lot from the moment she was diagnosed. You have to figure out what this is and symptoms and how to provide care. But AFTD had a closed social network that was, you were really able to ask questions, get a variety of answers from people that were going through the journey. And I think the AFTD really provided a lot of help for me, if you will, in that last year of her journey.
Yeah, it's a constant learning curve. Not only you've got a loved one going through a condition like dementia, but they're going through a specific type of dementia where some of the support offered for people with Alzheimer's or Lewy body or whatever may well not be appropriate. So, you know, it's so important as you did, isn't it? In the end, you know, it took you a while, which is a shame, but you actually found the experts in that subject that, you know, you could relate to a lot more.
And yeah, absolutely. And we were so very close. We were so very intimate in our marriage that as the words faded, we were able to shift to more body language and intent and just the nature of who we were to each other, able to avoid or minimize a lot of the frustration and really get more to just, what can I do for you in this moment? And so much about dementia caregiving is meeting them in the moment, meeting them where they're at, understanding that where they're at could change weekly, daily, hourly, and you having to be very nimble. And that was fine. As her language diminished, first she started losing a lot of nouns, just no nouns in her sentences, or confusing a noun. And then eventually confusing pronouns and referring to herself in the third person. And then even that would wane. In her last year, she might use a sentence like, there that will be. And there's nothing for me to do or respond to that because I don't know what she's trying to get at. But what I found most helpful for her was just to give her that affirmation. She said, "There, that will be." I will say, "It will be, huh?" And she'll go, "Yeah." And the smile would come and she would feel like she was recognized, or what she was trying to say was acknowledged. But then I would look for the other cues. I mean, she developed cues where if she would pick at her arm, it just meant that she was cold. It's like, okay, I'm going to get a jacket around her. I was very blessed with my wife. Whenever she got warm, the first thing that would happen was her cheeks would get very flushed. And so I'd watch for that and go, okay, she's too hot. If she wrung her hands, that means she had to use the bathroom. And sometimes I would just inquire. I'd say, "Do you want to go for a walk? Are you hungry?" or something to that effect. And not worry so much about what she said. It's just trying to address her needs.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
This week's guest on the D-Word podcast is author Scott Rose, who tells the story of caring for his wife Maureen in the book We Danced, Our Story of Love and Dementia.
And certainly in the last year, the condition had gotten so advanced that I had multiple professionals say, "Scott, she really needs to be in a care facility," because FTD is a very young onset dementia. And, you know, I was still working and financials required me to continue to work. And so reluctantly, I placed her in a care facility. And to your earlier point is most professionals in that environment have been trained on Alzheimer's. It is, you know, the most common. And so they were treating her like she had Alzheimer's. And there's such stark and significant differences that I would provide write-ups to the staff, the care staff, and say, you know, I mean, they're all good people, but this was their training. And I had to kind of widen that training to explain what the difference was with FTD, because in her case, it affected her executive function. So they couldn't sit her down at the dining table and expect her to eat. She would look at the plate, she'd get a bit confused or frustrated, she'd just stand up and start walking again and not eat. And so when I would go there, and I went there every day, two or three times a day. Fortunately, I was very blessed that it was close to our home, and my work was flexible, so I could still see her multiple times a day. But I'd get there and I'd say, "Did she eat?" And they'd say, "No, she didn't." And I'd say, "Okay, well, why don't you bring a meal back out and I'll help her eat?" But I had to help her with the fork. Now sometimes she'd take the fork, and sometimes she needed me to use the fork. I'd help her with her drink. Sometimes she could pick up the glass, and sometimes not. And you have to be nimble and understand that that's going to require adjustments on a minute-by-minute basis.
Yeah, and then, you know, I guess, you know, you have to know the person, and you also have to treat the person like a person, not look at the disease always. And I do feel sometimes that, as you say, people in care facilities, great people, do a great job, but their training almost leads them to look at the disease, then look at the person, not the other way around.
I fully agree in that they have, you know, there's few staff and multiple residents. And so there has to be this level of efficiency in the care. And the way you get efficiency is by following steps. And how did you learn those steps? By studying the disease. And so you're right, the disease is more in the forefront than necessarily each individual person. Again, no negative commentary regarding any individual caregiver. They were all wonderful, but it required a lot of coaching. And for instance, when they would help her change her clothes, well, my wife had always been fiercely modest. And so when you've got a person that's a relative stranger starting to pull off your shirt, you know, she fought back, she pushed back, because they didn't explain what they were doing. They just started doing it. And somebody without necessarily that type of dementia might be okay with that and understanding that they're receiving help. But she did not. And so there was a lot of conversation, a lot of education. And unfortunately, there's also a lot of turnover with staff. And so you educate a couple great staff caregivers, and then they go to another facility and you've got new ones now, and you're retraining them again and again regarding FTD. And that it once they were there for a while, they started to understand my wife's Maureen's quirks, if you will, kind of the things that she needed in order to make her feel safe and make her feel comfortable. And that's human nature, is we start to kind of understand and connect with that individual better. And some of them that predetermined or prescribed training starts to kind of fall away a little bit and go, okay, this is what I know Maureen needs in order to be, to feel good, to feel safe. And that's wonderful. I mean, I'm, you know, again, they're great people, and that human nature starts to take over. But again, with the turnover, it feels like about every 3 months you're retraining somebody.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And, you know, I guess that's where really good care plans come into their own, and looking at people. But, you know, Maureen's in the care facility. You're at home. I mean, how aware were you with the need, and it is a big need for carers, to, you know, still look after yourself?
Yeah, again, it's one of those do as I say, not as I do. I didn't take great care of myself, and I was just hyper-focused 24/7 on her needs, and I could tell what was going well and not with her care because I was there so frequently. I was, like I say, I was in her care facility with her every day, typically twice a day, sometimes three times, depending on just, you know, what my work demands were. And I could tell when she hadn't eaten. I could tell when she was more agitated than normal. She, you know, my wife lost a tremendous amount of weight during that journey, but it was important that I kind of helped with the care, I'll say, whenever I arrived. If they're in the middle of changing her, she'd recognize me, and that was helpful. That was extremely helpful. Not always connecting the dots of we were married, you know, because that required interpretation of words. What does husband mean? But she trusted me as somebody safe, somebody that provided her comfort. And so it was like, great, yeah, I want him. So I would take over the changing of the clothes and explain what I was going to do before I did that, or with the eating. And sometimes she just wanted to walk, but I wanted her to eat as well because she was losing weight. So I'd have little foods that were calorie dense in my pocket. And as she would pace back and forth, I'd hand her food so that she could kind of eat as she was walking, just to try and get those calories in her. I tried Ensure drinks, which are, you know, high protein, high calorie drinks. And she wasn't sure what to do with them initially. And so what I did is I purchased several reusable Starbucks cups, and she was a big fan of Starbucks. And so I would pour the Ensure in the Starbucks cup, and I'd hand her the Starbucks cup. Well, then she would drink it right down, and it was good. So you find these ways to adapt. That's not in a book anywhere. Well, it's in my book, but I mean, it's not in a book anywhere. You have to sort of try different tactics to get her to continue to eat and to drink.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it is a strange situation, because with other illnesses, you will go to your doctor, go to your GP, and now go here in the UK. And you know, usually it will be, well, this is wrong, this is the solution, go away and follow this path. Whereas, you know, when you get something like FTD, when you get diagnosed with Alzheimer's, or, you know, my mother-in-law was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 5 years ago. And it really was, well, here is the diagnosis. And suddenly that path that you're used to and you expect when you go into a medical facility, just, you know, it's just not there anymore.
Absolutely. You know, when you go in for an illness, there is a path to being well. And when you go in and you get diagnosed with dementia, there's not a path to getting well. That's the commonality for dementia, is it eventually proves fatal. And so we're kind of figuring what this path is. When she was diagnosed in June of 16, her neurologist was very matter of fact. She said, Maureen, you have 7 to 10 years left. And it was just sort of matter of fact. And we were just stunned. So in the same appointment where she was told she had dementia, she was also told she had 7 to 10 years left. And as it turned out, from that moment, she passed away just a little over 3 years later. And so not understanding how the pace of this path, I have worked with individuals where their loved one has had FTD for 6 or 7 years and seems to generally still be healthy, and others that passed as quickly as my wife had. And so it's very unpredictable. FTD does not necessarily have stages. And I get that question a lot, like, well, this is what's going on with my loved one. What stage is that? And all that I can do is sort of, because they want to know what their path looks like, what their journey looks like, how they should plan. And all I can say is, well, my wife experienced that too, and it was about this point in her journey. And I said, that's the best that I can give you.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's very difficult in terms of any form of dementia. I mean, sadly, Maureen passed in October 2019. How long was it afterwards that you decided, well, I really want people to know about this, and started writing the book?
Oh, I had thought about it in her last year, because I was just so alarmed at the speed that she was deteriorating. And I just felt so ill-prepared for this deterioration. And because my wife was a very, I don't want to say shy, but more of just kind of a quiet personality, I thought of all the people that didn't know her, didn't know this amazing woman, this intelligent, this caring woman, this passionate, artistic, all these different aspects of her that so many people didn't know. I was, in some aspects of her life, I was the only one that knew that aspect of her. And I wanted to share that. And so there was a little bit of a panic in her last year, like, how am I going to share this? Should I write a book? Should I do something to that effect? But I didn't start anything like that during her last year. I wanted to be there for her as much as possible. But yes, she passed October 10th of 2019, and her service was, I believe, November 3rd. So a little less than a month. I started writing the book actually the end of that November of 19, quite soon. And a lot of it was just pulling together bits and pieces. Journals that she had written in, journals that I wrote in, both pre-journey and during the journey of dementia. Little love notes that we had traded back and forth. But it was a lot of it was just compiling all of these very separate commentaries on our life, if you will, together. And really starting to look at, well, what sort of book would this be? How would this pull together? And that was, as I said, kind of late November 2019. I finished the first draft in June of 20, edited throughout that summer, and then started looking for publishers in the fall of 20. Unsuccessful. We were in the middle of COVID, a lot of folks just not wanting to take chances on unknown authors. And so early 21, I decided to just self-publish and work with Amazon and made that happen that way, and had a couple editors involved as well that I hired to review and edit the book.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the D Word Podcast with my guest, Scott Rose.
I would say that writing the book helped to remove the anxiety that I expressed that I had during her last year of, will anybody know her? Will she be remembered? Will she be gone, this wonderful, amazing person, and nobody will know all the idiosyncrasies of her that made her so wonderful? And so there was almost, I don't want to describe it as a panic, but almost sort of a, I owe this to her to make sure she is remembered and remembered well, remembered the way that she should be. Share the most intimate stories that really defined her character. And I just, it sort of became, I'll say, if I had let too much time pass, I might have pushed away from it, not done it at all. But it was almost sort of this sequential series of steps. She passed, we had the service, I start writing the book. And it was this is what I do. I'm the survivor of this couple, if you will. And to honor her well, I need to do these things. And I don't want to make it sound like it was mechanical and not deeply emotional. It was. There were many times I had to stop writing because it was such a raw memory. But it became just something that I thought she was owed. And when it was done, I felt that anxiety sort of lift. Like, good. Now, if something happens to me, I know her story is captured. You know, as pragmatic as that might sound, you know, in my career, I'm a project manager. So I look at things in steps and I try and make that happen.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, perfectly ended the project there with that. Although you didn't end the project, did you? Because, you know, a lot of people, having done all that, gone through everything you've gone through, you know, some people would say, oh, I don't want anything to do with that anymore. That was a really rough part of my life. I've done the book. Thanks very much. I'm going to move on. But actually, I mean, you've got the We Are Us website. You're at conferences. You do book readings. And it's set up in our whole course here to raise the profile of FTD now.
Yes, it's... I've struggled to figure out what to do after my wife's passing. How do I fill my time, if you will? And her passing October of 19, I was grief-stricken for a period of time and still experience grief on a daily basis. But I isolated during that grief. And then in March of 20, the world came undone with COVID and we were all encouraged to isolate. So it gave me a great excuse just to continue my isolation. And I thought I need to do more to honor her, to serve her memory. And what does that look like? And I explored that because I didn't want to just kind of shuffle off this part of my life. And again, everybody is different. And I don't fault anybody that wants to put this behind them. I have, like I say, I facilitate a caregiver support group. And when their loved one passes, sometimes they stay with the group to share their journey with others. But sometimes they say, you know what, I need to end this. It was a bad time of my life, and I need to move forward. And I completely respect that. And what I do is I offer them a handful of grief resources, either in-person counselors or books or whatnot. And I say, you know, any of these are available to you. Please, you know, reach out to those if you're grieving. And you're always welcome to rejoin the group or to connect with me one-on-one for coffee or what. But for me, yes, I wanted to continue to find ways to honor her. And certainly releasing the book was important. But I do put myself in a situation where I can speak at conferences. I ask to speak at conferences, and sometimes, you know, they'll reach out to me. It's always surprising to me how much knowledge there is of what our journey was. I will get people that I've never heard from reaching out and saying, hey, I'd love for you to come speak at our conference. And as you mentioned, I've done a few podcasts and, the book readings, you know, kind of hit and miss, if you will. But what's nice is people really want to focus more on our story rather than just the book. And I think that's wonderful. I have spoken at Chapman College down in Southern California to a group of about 50 students that were getting into the caregiving profession. And I had met the professor at a conference where I was just selling our book. And we had connected, and then she called me up a few months later and asked me to come speak to her class. And it was incredible because there was only one student of the 50 that actually had a family member with dementia. So they didn't really have that direct experience of that journey. And so I had prepared not only, you know, sharing our story, but also just more about dementia caregiving, the need to be very nimble, borrowing a few components from Tipa Snow, and really kind of setting a good stage for them. And then shared a short video, a 4-minute video of my wife so they could understand this language struggle. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house when we were done, but they, I think, left that with a much greater understanding of the value they're about to add to the world by being caregivers. And they had a much more direct connection, I think, than what we would get out of a book.
And I think, you know, the important thing is, as we come to a close in our chat, is that it is a book which is about you, it's about Maureen, and it features FTD. It is not an FTD textbook. And I do find that sometimes people want to look for the, it's all about, what was the FTD? But this is your story. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, I tell people it is first and foremost a love story. And there is an FTD component to it for certain. I mean, 2/3 of the book is our FTD journey. And I have had readers write to me and say, well, you don't talk about FTD till chapter 6. Why is that? And I say, well, because it's not an FTD textbook. It's a story of my wife's life. And I sort of rushed through the first aspect of her life in chapter 1. And chapter 1 ends with me meeting her. And then chapters 2 to the end is our life together. And very much focused on her and or my reactions to what was going on in her life and in her journey with dementia. But I try to incorporate milestones, things that we tried and failed, and some things that we succeeded in. And so people can read that not as a roadmap, but as just an additional resource in their journey. There are people that rely on different things to help them. Some need it very much step by step. I need a guide. And others are like, I just want to know that I'm not alone, that others have gone through a similar journey. And so they're looking for more of a story. And this is definitely more of a story than a textbook. And I found myself, as pragmatic as I am, I was not looking for a guide. I was, especially in my grief after she passed, as I was looking for somebody that could just relate. And I think everybody needs something different. If all we produced were textbooks, it would be very clinical. I saw many books on what is happening in your brain when you have dementia. I thought, you know what? I don't really need that. That's not for me. What I need is what happened when, what did you do when this happened? Or what did you do when that happened? And walking through that journey. And it is a very long journey. And I had people say I could make the book half as long, but it's some have referred to it as the long goodbye. And I wanted people to understand the roller coaster that happens where the health will plummet and then they may rally and then it may plummet again. And I want to take the readers on that journey, not so much the FTD journey, but the journey between her and I and how we navigated that and how we changed and adapted and she changed and adapted too, because, you know, being in a care facility was very foreign to her and trying to live her life in this very foreign environment and looking for me and that can tear you apart for certain. A quick anecdote is that she came to one of the staff members while I was at work, and she asked, where's my baby? And many people with Alzheimer's, they'll tell you that women may revert back to their younger selves when they had a child. That's where their memory is most comfortable at. And so the care facility, to their credit, had about 8 dolls in this one room. So the staff member, again, trained in Alzheimer's, took my wife to this room. And she picked up a doll and she handed it to Maureen. And apparently, and I was not there, but I was told that Maureen looked at the doll, said, ugly, and threw it down on the ground because it had matted hair and who knows what. And she left the room and she went to look for another staff member. And she said, where's my baby? And the staff member looked at her and she looked at the other and she said, hey, I tried to give her a doll and she wasn't interested. And it was at that time that I had come into the room and I'd had my lunch break. And I saw her and I'd always introduced myself and I said, ta-da. So she would create that relationship of voice and the individual. And she looked up and she went, there's my baby. She went there and went to me. So because she couldn't explain it other than to say, my baby, and she had to figure out, they had to figure out what that meant.
I think it's a lovely place to end, Scott. Maureen will be very proud of what you've achieved, I'm sure. We Danced, Our Story of Love and Dementia is the book, and thank you so much for being my guest.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
My thanks to Scott, and do check out his website at weareus.net. And the book is called We Danced, Our Story of Love and Dementia, and is available from all major online bookstores. Well, that's it for another edition of the D Word podcast. Hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll join me again soon for some more dementia talk.